This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the programme. We don't see this as a personal finance programme. There's quite enough discussion of all of that elsewhere. But the business of taking our money and choosing where to invest it is a particularly important one, important to anyone with savings or a pension. And a particularly interesting one too. Firstly, it shapes the economy because it's responsible for allocating capital and choosing which other industries get the money to grow and which don't. So even though you can't eat investment management, it might shape what you do eat. Secondly, it's an industry vulnerable to dysfunction in that it's very hard for clients, even very clever clients, to tell who's good at allocating capital and who is just lucky. And that means that customers looking to have their money invested have little idea about who is worth paying for that task. And as we gaze upon the world of finance, we do observe some expensive providers of dubious quality. So on the programme today, we'll look at the investment management industry. We have been, of course, motivated to do that by the troubles at Neil Woodford's Equity Income Fund. And if the three people with me can't help us make sense of all of this, then we really do need some help. So let me introduce my guests. First up is Bella Caridad Ferreira, Chief Executive and Founder of Fundscape, a research company that looks at the UK fund industry. And Bella, you're going to be our objective, impartial, external observer to some extent today.
Yes, I'm representing the consumers today.
Right. Now, can we just talk about charges? Because we'll get into this later, but in terms of I take £10,000, I invest it in something, I would love there to be one fee, an annual fee, that is everything that I'm paying for the administrative cost of that. Just take me through all the different charges that might at some point be taken from me.
You have to pay your advisor, which could be around about 0.5%. You then pay for the fund. You then pay for the custody of that fund, so where it sits on an investment platform.
So you need to explain that one.
I'll explain.
I can understand I'm paying the fund. There's a person employed to allocate my money. But what's this platform one?
So an investment platform essentially is a very sort of efficient machine where you can hold all your investments rather than holding them directly with the fund company. They're all stored in the same place. It should be more cost effective, but it does also cost money to sit there. It's a bit like your online bank, but you've got all your investments in one place.
Right. So you might have that fee if you've got lots of investments.
Yes, yeah. So there'll be a small fee, and that could be 0.25%.
Because the one that slightly worries me is I pay the fund manager, and then the fund manager, every time they buy or sell a share, they're paying someone else for that particular right, aren't they? And this all adds up, doesn't it?
It all adds up. I like to use analogies that people can understand. So if we think about a supermarket, when you go in and buy that loaf of bread or that pint of milk, it's been through a whole chain of supply from the cow that's produced the milk, from the farmer that bottled it up and so on. So each step of that chain has to be paid for. So you're creaming off.
We got it.
You're creaming off a little bit at each step of the way.
OK, anyway, we'll come back to charges, but we appreciate that there's a lot of people who, if you like, have got their finger in the pie. There's one basic term which, before we get going, I want you to explain. Mm-hmm. Passive and active.
OK, so I think we all know what a stock market index is, for example, like the FTSE 100, which tracks the market cap of the top 100 FTSE companies. And what a passive fund does is it replicates that. So it just buys a slice of each of those companies and puts them into a fund and can do that very cheaply.
Passive because you don't have to do a lot of thought or thinking.
Because there is no thinking. It's just literally replicating.
Right.
An active manager aims to beat the index. And so he will use his judgment.
Or her.
He or she will use...
Sorry, very gender neutral.
He or she will use his judgment, his knowledge, his understanding of the market to try and outperform that market.
But they will...
The index.
They will pick, yeah.
They will pick. Now, some of them will not pick very well, and we call them closet index trackers. So they charge a big fee for doing essentially what a passive fund does. And others are very high conviction investors and will James.
We'll meet one,
who will largely ignore what is going on and pick from their conviction and from their gut feel.
And just to link the active-passive distinction, and the charges discussion we've had, you will generally pay more for an active investment manager.
You will pay more for an active investment, yes, absolutely.
And they're doing more work.
And okay, they are.
Bella, thank you for that. Right, let us introduce our next two guests, each of whom are investment managers. James Anderson, partner at Baillie Gifford, Edinburgh-based investment business. And James, you're a joint manager of the Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, which is actually the worst branded investment trust because it's nothing to do with mortgages. In fact, not very much to do with Scotland other than being based there.
No, I'll claim the parallel, though, is Berkshire Hathaway. Mr. Buffett's done okay off that rather odd name, too.
Right. So tell us what you do. You're an active manager.
I'm definitely an active manager. So in Bella's terms, we only have 3% overlap with the index, the world index, in what we do. And beyond that, we also have approximately, and you may want to come onto this later, 20% of the portfolio invested in companies that are not yet quoted and may indeed never be quoted.
How big is your fund altogether?
Scottish Mortgage is something over £8 billion. It's a member of the FTSE 100 in and of itself.
In and of itself. Now, tell us some of the companies you invest in.
Well, our largest holding now, as it has been for many years, is in Amazon. We've been shareholders of Amazon since 2004-05.
Good time to get in?
Yes.
Not the best time?
I'll take it. As I'm sure we'll come on to, we make lots of mistakes as well, but I think it is intrinsic to how we see markets working and what we think is very different from index investors, in that we think returns over very long periods of time are actually dominated by an extraordinarily small number of companies. One of the pieces of research that we most value is one about the American stock market since 1926, which when you think about it, it's quite a good time to frame it from, which of the near 25,000 companies in the US stock market, half the excess returns over bonds comes from just 90 companies. So it's about trying to find those brilliant companies. And to be honest, you will make mistakes in that process, and I think we ought to both acknowledge that and to accept that that is actually part of the task.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that. Thank you for that, James. So Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, not really to do with mortgages, but is one of the biggest investment trusts in the UK. Let me introduce my third guest, Sean Haggerty, Managing Director of Vanguard Europe. Now, Vanguard, Sean, set up in the States, became extremely successful. Broadly speaking, I associate you with passive investing.
Yes. And I think most probably do, although we would prefer to be associated with low-cost investing because the firm has been quite successful globally. We manage over £4 trillion in assets on behalf of mostly individual
clients.
Say
that number again.
Over £4 trillion.
Right. So that is a lot bigger than something like James's investment trust.
It happens to be. Yeah.
No, I just wanted people to be alert to the change in magnitude that we went from there.
Yeah, sure. But importantly, over £1 trillion of that is actually actively managed.
Okay.
Either by Vanguard managers, and in full disclosure, Baillie Gifford, where James works, happens to be a sub-advisor for some Vanguard funds because we oftentimes go to look for managers that we think can add value at a low cost. So we are not necessarily all about index. We are about low cost.
Low cost. But you do have a lot of index funds as well.
We do.
So if I can just go to you and I can say, I'd like to invest in the Japanese stock market, and you'd probably have something that would allow me to do that.
We would.
Yeah. Right. I think we've got the basics there. So we have, if you like, one company more passive and one very active investor. Let us just scope out what goes on here, because I'm particularly interested in the active ones, James, and you'll all have opinions on it. I'm fascinated to know what you do when you get to work in the morning. You go to work, James, you're an active investment fund manager. Coffee, then what?
A very big part of my task is not responding. So you were asking me about Amazon earlier. In that close to 15 years of our ownership, there has been a point in every year, at least once, where the share price of Amazon, because they've reduced earnings or whatever else overnight, falls by 10 to 15%. Now, in the course of the share price going over those 15 years from $35 to close to $2,000, the most important thing is to be able to get away from that instinct to panic and to overvalue instant information. So in all honesty, what we try and do is spend our time assembling networks of connections with both people running businesses in a deeply serious way for the long term rather than for the short term, and heavily and increasingly with academics and scientists who can understand the world at a deep level.
Give me an example of a useful insight that might kind of bear upon an investment decision you might make.
We are the largest external investors in Tesla, particularly in America, as Sean will know. This is a deeply controversial position, partly because of Mr. Musk himself and his temperament, and partly because of what they are doing. Now, how do we think about that? We spend a lot of time trying to understand whether the dynamics of battery technology in particular, to some extent associated technologies like solar, are in a sense parallel to that most important investment piece of information of the last 50 years, which is Moore's Law. Now, frankly,
Moore's Law is that the price of processing power gets cheaper and cheaper.
And how do we think about that? If the price of batteries carries on, or the performance of batteries carries on improving at 20% plus rates per annum, frankly, a lot of the noise surrounding whether orders this year or what Mr. Musk may have said do not matter a great deal. At some point out there, even if you take out all the climate issues and the like, the world will be driving electric vehicles. Now, if we can have insight into that process over the course of time, then that makes a difference. Now, of course, you have to talk to Tesla and the other companies, and particularly the rivals of it within the traditional internal combustion engine. But we think you also need to talk to those who can give you observations about how these technologies do develop. And for an example of that, we spend a lot of time, thought, energy, increasing links with the Santa Fe Institute, which does a huge amount of work on understanding where that goes.
I think we've got it. I mean, that is, I think, one of the most sort of interesting concrete examples of what a good and active investment manager must do, is to ask a question that will really bear on the value of a company, takes a completely long-term perspective, and takes a bet, essentially, at the end of it based on the assessment of the risks.
And it may go wrong. The world is complex.
Yeah. Sean, I'd love to hear your view of what James has described.
I think that what is oftentimes deeply misunderstood by the average investor is the concept of risk and how you think about risk. Because we fear that people think of the word of risk and think of it as scary. And we fear that people are missing out on building more wealth because the industry has started to define risk as the difference between, and this is the big misunderstanding, between speculation and investment. And what James is talking about is investment, 15-year holding periods.
Yeah.
Very different than what happened in the stock market today based on what the Fed said yesterday. And so now let's talk about that risk one step further. We know that taking risk in the stock market generally can create wealth over the long term. James is right that a small number of companies generate that wealth. The question is, can you find somebody with the skill that actually can choose those or not? And so there is a second risk, which is important to understand. There's market risk, and then there's an active risk that you take when you choose a manager. And I think that that is the second order challenge for an individual investor. As you pointed out at the beginning, one thing I have to do is say, let me invest overall. That's the most important decision to make, and one I hope we don't discourage.
The second decision is
index or active. Index, we believe, should be a core of a portfolio. There should be some indexing in a portfolio. To the extent that you take active risk, you do have to do homework to find out who has skill and who has luck, and you need third parties to help you, like Bella, to help you discern the difference between the two.
Okay, my worry is, Bella, you can't even tell who the good ones are and the bad ones.
Well, no, you can't, because you the only way you can evaluate that is on the past track record. And of course,
and that may be no guide to future performance, because they may have been unlucky. They're really intelligent, well thought through bets.
Absolutely.
And they just didn't happen to turn out right.
I mean, there are lots of ways that you can evaluate a manager. You look at whether, you know, if I'm looking at James, has he stuck to his investment objective? Has he drifted from his investment investment style, there are lots of warning signals. But this is the only industry that I know of where you have to, it's a bit like getting on a bus. You have no idea what's at the end of that journey. Mm. So you have to get on the bus and you take the risk of ending up perhaps doing really, really well or not at all well.
Can I just get into this issue of passive versus active? So first of all, James is regarded as one of the best active investors. Are they all, I don't want to ask James this because he'll be too modest, but Sean, Bella, are all the active investors doing what James is doing? My impression is not.
Well, no. Let's imagine if we take a sector and we have 100 people in it, the average is going to be the index tracker, the index. 50% are going to be better than that and 50% are going to be worse than that. I would rather be investing with the ones who are better.
Yeah.
But even that's not a straightforward, simple choice, because if the cost of investing with that person who is generating better returns is eroded by inflation and other costs, then you may be better off anyway in an index tracker.
Because let me put some data around that. We know in the past 15 years, UK investors, when they're choosing funds, 88% of global equity funds did not beat their benchmark.
So effectively, you'd do better with the index, just investing
than
in some random, you know,
than
the average active investor.
One thing we know for sure is those who charge too much will hardly ever beat their particular benchmark. And so it's costs and charges
that
erode returns. Mm-hmm. And if we started to get to a more level playing field where people are, like James, willing to charge less based on assets that they have under management, then I think we'd have a better chance of seeing those active funds actually outperform the index.
Let's divide the market up. So we've got value investors, people who really try and work to think about long-term performance. We've got a more, if you like, less classy active investor who are buying and selling, probably more than you're buying and selling, I imagine, James. What do you buy and sell each year of your portfolio?
Our turnover is less than 10% per year.
Right, and that would be low, I would think, by the standards of active.
Oh, hugely.
Incredible.
Yeah, very low, yeah.
So there are a lot of people who are buying and selling all the time, running up costs when they do that, because that costs. And then you've got the passives. Now, maybe invest in the index. Here's my problem with the passives, Sean. If everybody went passive, there'd be maybe one sucker who was making actually all the decisions, and the entire weight of capital allocation would be on that one person.
Yep.
And that doesn't seem like a very good way for the industry to go. You do want there to be more than, say, James working out whether we should be in Tesla or not. We want lots of people taking independent decisions so that the world is a sort of outcome of a crowdsourced thought.
It's something we hear a lot ever since, really since the global financial crisis, there has been a significant secular shift and I think cyclical shift into index funds globally. Our view would be that the industry takes too much out of the middle and does not leave enough return for the investor. So rather than worry about the size of indexing being too big, I'd worry about it being too small. And I think we have a long way to go in Europe. 15%, I think we could double and not have any issue whatsoever.
I think broadly we agree with Sean, and it's one reason why we admire what Vanguard have done. We believe the cost is the one thing that you can control in this, Sean. So if I take the Scottish mortgage part of this, we charge it as total expenses ratio of 0.37%.
Just ask what that is. If I invest £100, I would be paying 37p in annual charges to you for the stewardship of that £100.
Yeah, and we
that's not very much.
That's the ongoing charge figure, is it?
That's the ongoing charge.
That's everything
figure.
Included.
As you know even better than I do, Bella, that there have been so many changes of definition, but that is a consistent figure. So that pays for our fees as managers. It pays for the expense of the board and all other legal costs, etc. Now, scale does matter in this, Evan, but we think that is absolutely critical, and we think that there is a danger that people do cite these figures, as indeed we have just been doing, 0.37% of your assets in this. But shouldn't it be much more relevant to think about it in terms of the improvement in performance you're getting and the percentage of that you get? Mm-hmm. And I was saying to Sean as we came in that, you know, I think one of the distressing parts from my point of view is that over my 35-year career, the fees for active management have basically not come down. Now, there is passive pressure, and I ascribe a lot of this to something that we haven't talked about, which is the rise of the hedge fund industry and the extraordinary returns that they claim to make. But in fact, they're making returns for the fund managers. You know, as Warren Buffett would say, it's a scheme of remuneration rather than a scheme of outperformance. And I think that has biased both the repute of the industry and the overall cost base.
They sound very clever, don't they? They have very sophisticated...
Oh, they are sure they are very clever.
Yeah. And then they racked up a much higher fee structure for themselves.
And so, you know, in America, there are several multi-billionaires whose investment record, if taken in aggregate, is that they have underperformed the indices.
But they've charged
but they've
very
made a lot of money out
for
of
the
it.
Year that they happen to outperform.
And I think showing a little maths helps here. And the average UK investor, I think when Bella, you talked about the different charges, asset management, platform fee, oh, if you have a personal pension, maybe there's a fee for that as well, and then there's fee for advice. It can add up to 2% pretty quickly.
And that 2% of your capital assets
is
a lot when you're only going to be getting 4% in quite a good year, potentially.
It might well be 50% of your returns.
But let me just give you one little stat here, which is that if you took £10,000 and invested it over a lifetime, let's say 50 years, and I would be generous, let's say 7% return, you would generate an end value of £300,000. If you charged 2% per year, it would reduce to close to £100,000 of an end value.
These figures are amazing because there's a lot of work going on in the compounding here.
There is a lot of work going on in the compounding, but what I think we, as an industry, talk about the compounding of returns, I don't think we talk about the compounding of costs. Okay. And the difference between 2% and 0.37% is astounding when you take it out over a long time period. And I don't think that, and here's the important thing. The investor's taking all of the risk and giving two-thirds of the return to the industry that is taking none of the risk. If you're taking the risk, you should get the return.
I always remind fund managers that managing other people's money is a privilege. And so you have to exercise the greatest care and skill. And if that means doing nothing, then you do nothing at all. But it does mean really being very clear about your investment objectives, doesn't it? And sticking to that and looking for the long-term returns and performance. Risk is definitely part of that. Right. When my son was born 23 years ago, I put some money into the Invesco Rupert Fund at the time, which was a high-charging fund, 1.5%, bought it directly, put £500 in, and then set up a standing order, £50 a month. And being a really terrible mother, I didn't actually check that fund for years and years and years. And I decided to bite the bullet and run an experiment, and I measured that fund against a deposit, an L&G index tracker, and the worst performing UK stock market fund I could find that was still surviving. So my £12,500 investment in that fund for my son actually outperformed. I was lucky. I was really lucky. But it could have gone the other way. So the range of investment goes from 30 all the way down to about 8,000.
It really does make a difference.
It makes a big difference.
It's very hard to say that you were clever in that particular situation.
Oh, it wasn't.
You picked something. Can we talk about Neil Woodford? And I appreciate you may not want to get too personal about another investor. So the situation is he had an equity income fund. He has lots of other funds. He has faced a particular problem that a lot of investors wanted their money back when it wasn't performing well, and he had too many illiquid assets in there that he couldn't quickly dispose of, and he wasn't able to pay the money back. The fund has been suspended. You can't get your money at the moment. But what I'm interested in, though, is if he's a very clever investor and he is looking over the long term, it might well be that his problem is that investors grow impatient when it doesn't look like he's keeping up with the market in the short term, and he gets wiped out. And if you like, the short-term time horizons of many buyers who don't quite know where they should be putting their money makes it very difficult to be patient and to be long-term, because what your client's patience runs out before yours does. Now, is that a problem? I mean, is that a problem you have to face, James, or you, Sean?
Generally, I would say across the industry, across the many decades that the fund industry has existed, if you look at it through that time frame, I would say no. I don't think that there is evidence that you have widespread problems. What's interesting, I think, is the infrequency of events like you see recently in the UK market across decades and across thousands of funds. It is relatively infrequent, and therefore we think of it as somewhat idiosyncratic. You know, that said, asset managers do have to understand that their investors can come and ask for their money back, and they have to manage liquidity within the portfolio. And that seems to be the issue here.
James, you made a really interesting point when you were speaking earlier. You said that you have made mistakes. Mm. And people do make mistakes when they're managing money. And we can't be short-termist when we're looking at a fund. The question, I think, here with Woodford was he just lagging? Has he had enough time to correct the fund? Or was the run on the fund so substantial that he just couldn't do anything
else? The run on the fund was because of the underperformance of the fund. So, I mean, in a way, the illiquidity and the run is a consequence of a problem, which was the investors grew impatient and out of trust with the man who was looking after their money. Yeah. So the question is in an ideal world, would they maybe say, hey, he's had a good record over the decades, and so maybe we should give him more time, even though he's lost 2/3 of the value? And that's a really difficult, lively question. Well, I would begin to lose trust in someone if they lost 2/3 of the value.
I'm not sure that he has permanently lost that 2/3
of
the money.
No.
I think Neil Woodford was, I know him a little, but not well, was trying fundamentally to do something quite honourable, which was to provide finance for a set of innovative British companies, very different from what we find in the FTSE 100, or indeed to his old investment habits, that were otherwise not easily being financed. Now, I think that was an honourable attempt. Now, I may be sceptical whether there are, sadly, enough British companies that you can really do that with much hope of success. But, you know, I think the fundamental task was not a dishonourable one. In that sense, I think it was actually better than many supposedly active, Bella, as you put it, people who are just trying to do a little bit different from the index or from a hedge fund taking enormous returns.
He was a value investor who was making an effort to actually appraise the value of what he was buying rather than speculating and guessing.
There was a stylistic change, which Bella referred to. You know, he made his reputation investing in the likes of pharmaceutical companies and tobacco companies at scale
He did drift from his star, and that's the warning bell.
We'll leave it there then. On that note, before we open up any cans of worms in this industry, let me thank my guests, Bella Caridad Ferreira, founder of Fundscape, James Anderson, a partner at Baillie Gifford, the Edinburgh-based investment business, and James jointly manages the Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, which I keep repeating is nothing to do with mortgages, and Sean Haggerty, the managing director of Vanguard Europe, American company with many passive investment vehicles. And I will be back with more guests next week. Thank you for listening. The programme was produced by Leslie McAlpine. And if you enjoyed this edition of The Bottom Line, you can subscribe to the series on BBC Sounds or your preferred podcast provider.